Go ahead and get started, brethren. We have quite a bit to cover this morning, so we left off yesterday in our discussion with what was being taught or adhered to in the Northern Kingdom with reference to Ahab and Jezebel, and we asked ourselves what was being taught, what were they doing, and so of course our references took us to Revelation, the second chapter, where we have the message that was given to the ecclesia there with regards to what Jezebel was doing and how they had suffered or permitted her to teach these things to their servants or to my servants. And of course we see that this was the ecclesia members who needed the help and support of a solid brother, of solid managing brethren, to help avert, to help recognize what was taking place. And so this was what was happening in the north. We see that this, in effect, as we've studied, is spiritual adultery, and this was breaking down the standards and bringing the world into the ecclesia, wasn't it? Or taking the members of the ecclesias into the world without a second thought and going back and forth, as well as consorting with the world or those who have perverted the teachings of Christ and the apostles and both their immoral practices and their religious views. Now, sometimes we've heard it said, do they really believe that much different than we do? Is it really that far off? Maybe we don't have that many differences as we think. Well, we know for a fact that when we begin to marginalize, when we begin to erase that line of demarcation between what the truth is and what is a lie, then before we know it, the truth is perverted and we have apostasy. And that's what was taking place in the north. So back in 2 Chronicles 17, we'll be kind of going through these quickly today to try to catch up where I was trying to get to. I kept mentioning yesterday in the meanings of these names, and I thought we'd get to that yesterday. So we're a little bit behind, but we see how the great heights that Jehoshaphat reached in opposition to false doctrine. He strengthened himself, as we read, and he understood the difference in what was pleasing to God and what was pleasing to man. He understood what was the easy path, the easy road, and what wasn't so easy. And here in this third year, and that's really an interesting study as well, when we go back through and see some of the things that happened in the third year of the kings and different examples there, we kind of find out that there's a little bit of a time of preparation, a time of separation, a time to get things ready. And then in the third year, more often than not, we see the trials begin. And that's what we see here. In the third year, he set out to educate the people, as our discussion, our class was devoted to yesterday, educating. And so we remember Ahab had been reigning in Israel for now 6 years. And look again who Jehoshaphat sends out to do the work. He says that in these verses here, we have, beginning in verse 7, the third year he set his princes, even Ben-Hail and Obadiah and Zechariah, and to Nathaniel and Micaiah to teach in the cities of Judah. And with them he sent the Levites, even Shemaiah and Nathaniah and Zebadiah and Ashiel and Shemarimoth and Jehohanan and Adonijah and Tobijah and Tobadijah the Levites, and with them Elishama and Jehoram the priests. Interesting names. And so when we look at this, we have names with these divine titles in them, like we mentioned. We have names like Ben-Hail, son of might, Obadiah, serving Yahweh. We have Zechariah meaning Yah hath remembered, and so on. And so the names had something to do with divine titles involved in the names of these men who were set forth to do this work in teaching and leading the people. Now, as we interject in here, we see these numbers are interesting as well. It's the numbers of these individuals that we consider and thinking of the message that's also set forth for us. We have the five princes. These five, five is the number of grace or mercy. And as we see, number nine There were 9 Levites, these names mentioned here, and in 9 is the number of judgment or justice, with also regards to mercy and truth. Also, we have the 2 priests, and 2 is the number of division or separation. And so while Jezebel in the north was teaching God's people to commit fornication and to eat things sacrificed to idols, Jehoshaphat was teaching in his ecclesia, by what we see presented for us here, we see him teaching God manifestation. In other words, the manifestation of God's mercy and his truth will separate you from the things of the world. This is the idea, of course, when we see these numbers. Separation is the very substrata of what we know God manifestation is. You cannot display manifestation of God where there is no separation from the world or from false teaching or from another gospel. Exclusive fellowship, then, brothers and sisters, is a scriptural principle that we gain from understanding in these numbers. The 5 princes, the 9 Levites, and the 2 priests, separation. And in these numbers, we have an indication of what they are teaching here in Judah at this time. And it was a principle set forth from here on. And they go forth carrying this book of the law that we mentioned yesterday. And imagine these men with the scrolls under their arms, going into the villages, people coming around them and opening the scrolls and explaining what God's word was all about. And then on to the next village, and so on, the next city. Throughout all Judah went these men, powerful men, because this is the way that they were trying to revolutionize any group of believers, to revolutionize and strengthen our ecclesias. We go and we educate, we teach, and you convince by the power of the word and of the truth. The very power of that word makes the mind seek those things which are from above in our class yesterday, because it's the process of thinking, the process of learning, the process of understanding that a spiritual mind is then developed, and how very, very important this is in these days in which we live. We can see plainly the effects of the policy of Jehoshaphat then. Judah was now at peace as the people were prepared. When we look at verse 10, we read, "And the fear of the Lord fell upon all the kingdoms of the land and that were round about Judah, so that they made no war against Jehoshaphat." So we have this time of peace. He gave them peace so that this job of education that we're talking about could take place. Education can be done, and it was done when the principle of Proverbs 16, verse 7, which teaches us, "When a man's ways please the Lord, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him." And so in this period of Jehoshaphat's life, he diligently applied himself, as we see in verse 11. And so we see that even some of the Philistines and the Arabians gave him enormous quantities of animals and presents. Some of the Philistines brought Jehoshaphat presents, tribute silver, and the Arabians brought him flocks, 7,700 rams and 7,700 he-goats. So when we look at this for a moment, again, we're trying to see what's involved in each of these verses. We see a much deeper meaning. We see the Philistines represented the uncircumcised, which the word and policy had a positive effect on now. They were deliberately not called the uncircumcised here, as they'd been referred to in other cases, because here in this verse, the word is teaching us that they are no longer considered uncircumcised, but the word of God had made them understand and know who was in control, who the true God of Israel was, or of Judah at this time. And each of these represents certain peoples outside the camp of Judah now bringing presents, paying obeisance to this great king. We see them bringing silver and tribute. Of course, we know that silver is a symbol of redemption. The Arabians representing to us everything that is opposed to God. And we have the example in Nehemiah 2:19, where Gershom was berating them for rebuilding the temple walls. We have the number 7,700 mentioned twice. Now this, of course, isn't by happenstance, is it? We know the number 7 is a complete number, but it's also, when we see it in this direction, in this way, mentioned these many times, we see the covenant number then being emphasized 7,700 twice, and then, of course, by the he-goats, of course, representing this sacrificial covenant, or this covenant number being emphasized in these animals. And so what this verse is saying then is that when the Word of God is taught properly, it has an effect even upon the most uncouth, the most animate despisers of the world, of the word, and out of people. God can bring them into covenant through redemption when the Word is taught and education is pursued. And so Jehoshaphat waxed great exceedingly doing this. And so by this, brethren, now in this part of the study, we see that this type of Jehoshaphat reign, like David's, was a parable of the kingdom, wasn't it? We see that those seek God and they destroy sin. We see Jehoshaphat's heart elevated and he destroys Balaam. We find that the kingdom is established in the hand of the new king, and all Judah serves and obeys him, exactly like when Christ comes. All Judah will serve and obey him and offer a gift. We see this from our studies in Zechariah, the 6th chapter, beginning at verse 12 through 15, how those from other lands far away would bring gifts and present them to the prince sitting upon the throne with his crown. And so the law goes forth from Zion under the direction of King Jehoshaphat and these priests, exactly like we see in the kingdom. All the kingdoms fear Yahweh round about, just as they will on a global scale in the age to come. There is no war. God made sure of that, exactly what will take place when they will learn war no more. And so Gentiles from the west and from the east on either side of Israel will bring new gifts to this king and pay homage, as we read in Psalm 72. The kings of Sheba and Seba, the kings of Tarshish from afar. We learn that the wastes of Judah are now rebuilt and the kingdom is filled with prosperity. And then finally, in this portion of our account, we see a faithful army takes the kingdom and he serves the king. And here is not only a parable, but this type as well as we're trying to bring out. Let's appreciate some of these things, brethren, the richness of the word that we see here in studying this account, the power of what we've seen here so far, and how this bolsters our faith, seeing and understanding this type of the kingdom before us. We understand also, brethren, that the only way we can rightly serve the Father, as we know from the New Testament, is in sincerity and in truth, to educate ourselves and our brethren, to set our affection on things above, and to mortify the deeds of the flesh, to be dead to sin, but alive unto God. And so now when we go into verse 12, we see that Jehoshaphat waxed great exceedingly, and he built in Judah castles and cities of store. And when we continue to kind of look into these definitions, we see that he waxed, from this word halak, to walk. He waxed great, gadel, meaning great or large, and exceedingly, me'al. And this is kind of linked to that word that we studied on our first day, al, meaning upward or above or overhead. And so here we have a phrase that tells us the direction then of Jehoshaphat. And this is the path that he was taking, the path of faith, the path that each of us must strive for as well. So we need to be walking greatly upwards towards our God. And this was the way he was doing. We read in verse 13 that he built these in Judah, these castles and cities of store, and he had much business in the cities of Judah. And so from this we gain that he is a very hands-on kind of a king. He was there leading his people, coming alongside them in true fellowship with his brethren, helping them, making them understand the importance of this policy that he had set forth. It reminds us, brethren, of Psalm 144, verses 1 and 2, where it says, "Blessed be the Lord my strength, which teacheth my hands to war and my fingers to fight." Verse 2, "My goodness and my fortress, my high tower," he says, "and my deliverer, my shield, and he in whom I trust, who subdueth my people under me." Think about the confidence we gain in this verse, the confidence that Jehoshaphat had, knowing that just miles away was Israel and this apostasy that was there. And not only that, but the animosity with the nations round about. He has Edom, Moab, Ammon, Syria, all licking their chops, all building their forces and getting ready to come against him. And so 2 Chronicles 17 continues with these men of war, mighty men of valor, who were there in Jerusalem. And we see that these are the numbers of them according to the house of their fathers of Judah, the captains of thousands. We have Adna, the chief, and with him mighty men of valor, 300,000. These are men of war, men ready to fight. And next to him was Jehoram, the captain, and with him 284,000. Next to him was Amasiah, the son of Zichri, who willingly offered himself unto the Lord, and with him 200,000 mighty men of valor. And of Benjamin, Eliada, mighty men of valor, and with him armed men with bow and shield, 200,000. And next to him was Jehozabad, and with him 180,000, ready, prepared for the war. Now again, let's look at this just for a minute before we go on. We have Adna, the name of this man, meaning pleasure. We think of this, it must have been a pleasure to serve under this captain and how he treated his men, knowing forcefully. Again, as we mentioned in the first verse, he sent these forces out. These were men of might and men of mind who were able and willing to go out and serve on behalf of Jehoshaphat and the policies he set forth. So it was a pleasure to serve under Adna. Jehohanan, Yahweh hath favored, or Yahweh favored. He favored him with responsibility, didn't he, when he gave him 280,000 men to serve under him. All warriors of faith, we might say. Amaziah, meaning Yah hath loaded. Yah hath loaded. Why did Yahweh load this man with this kind of responsibility? Well, he was the son of Zichri, which means memorable. So we see that this was a memorable family. And in 2 Chronicles 23:1, we have another son of Zichri that's mentioned here. And he was another faithful man. But Amasiah here is said to have willingly offered himself. Imagine that. Think of that in verse 16. He willingly offered himself. This was a man of war. This is the only record that we have, brethren, of what we find of this man, Amasiah. But think about this for a moment. If we could have this summary placed at the base of the record of our lives, wouldn't it be a most tremendous thing to willingly dedicate our lives? He was a man whom Yahweh had loaded with responsibilities, and he came from a memorable family, and he willingly offered himself. What a man he must have been. This word willingly offered, this word Nadab, is to impel, to volunteer spontaneously. He volunteered all that he had, all his service, to the truth and upholding it spontaneously. He didn't need to be coerced. He didn't need to be threatened. He didn't need to pause and think about it and discuss it with whoever he might have felt confidence in. He did it because he was compelled to serve. He knew what was right, and he did it. He offered Zabdek to slaughter the sacrifice. And Paul tells us in Romans 12 that we ought to offer ourselves as a living sacrifice. The same word, only here in the Greek, in the New Testament, as we see here in 2 Chronicles. He was a leader over 200,000 men of valor. In verse 17, then we see Eliada. And Eliada means Yah is knowing. And under him was 200,000 more men as well. And then in verse 18, we have Jehozabad, meaning Yah hath endowed. He had been endowed with the blessings because of his dedication and his faithfulness in his God. 180,000 men with him. And then it says that they were all ready, prepared for war. All ready, prepared for war. The war. These men were armed, prepared, and completely ready for a specific battle. But as we go into the next chapter 18, we see that the war they were about to engage in, they weren't ready for. they were about to go into a battle, and they had their policies changed. Well, we won't get into that yet, but we see that a lot of things changed for them, and so they weren't necessarily ready for this war. The war described at the end of verse 3 of chapter 18, was a war against the Syrians, an alliance with Ahab. And this is not what they were prepared for, but tragically, it was a war that they fought, and it became a disaster for them. In the 19th verse, we read, "And these waited on the king, besides those whom the king put in the fenced cities throughout all Judah." And so as we went through here, if you kind of added up all of these men and how they were served there, you'll find that there is 1,160,000 men in Jehoshaphat's army. 1,160,000 men. And that's besides all of those that were in the other cities. We also notice that that's not all. They all waited on the king. There's another group of men besides those. So we don't really know how many, but we know there was at least this 1,160,000. So Jehoshaphat obviously had a massive army. And this was the result of this policy and this campaign of education. These men, without a second thought, were willing to serve him and to defend their God. And he brought about this cohesiveness, this united ecclesia, we might say, of those who were willing to stand, to make a stand, and to fight for truth. This cohesiveness, people who were ready prepared to stand. And so, ready prepared for war. We think about the war against the encroachments of the world, things that we are up against, where it might have come from. Are we ready for it? Were they ready for it? But they had never fought that particular war because Jehoshaphat changed his policy. So the 17th chapter talks about him rising up, soaring. We talked about this to extent, walking greatly upwards. But we see that this 18th chapter is the opposite. So chapter 18, verse 1, we see again the richness of the text here and how it's left for us. Jehoshaphat had riches and honor and abundance, and he joined affinity with Ahab. And after certain years, verse 2, he went down to Ahab to Samaria. So we've covered so far the reason why Jehoshaphat had riches and honor and abundance. He was richly blessed. He had this gigantic army of 1,160,000 men, as well as we see why there was this time of peace that they were blessed with. He had the opportunity for education, all because of the policies that he put in place to serve Yahweh. And now we see a huge change in direction in this man, Jehoshaphat. As we read in verse 2, after certain years, he went down to Ahab. Ahab, as we talked about yesterday, being recorded as the worst king in Israel. Why? Why did this happen? Why did this happen? As we go through this, as we said, it's such a question in our minds from a man that's soaring, who had risen, whose heart was lifted up, and now he decides to join affinity with the apostasy. He had riches and honor in abundance. Is this a key factor that we see in the account here? He had riches and honor in abundance, and he joined affinity with Ahab. See in the record, it's linked together there perfectly. Let's explain the motive, and then we see why. We see he joined affinity, and then we'll talk about what that meant. We see that riches and honor and abundance may have been a big part of the problem here. It created in him a spirit of self-reliance, didn't it? Possibly. A spirit of self-reliance. He had so much. He had so many men. He'd been blessed so much. And as we said yesterday, often, more often than not, this breeds within us a spirit of laxness. We decide that we must be doing something right, and we take off from there. It created him a spirit of this self-reliance, and so we see that his father Asa's problem was developed later in life because of his own weakness and his ill-preparedness to face Baasha. Is this what was about to happen with Jehoshaphat? Jehoshaphat's self-reliance sprang out of his strength, though. He wasn't weak in any sense. He was very strong. So strong that he didn't know what to do, really, with all that he had. 1,160,000 soldiers and all the riches he could ever imagine. He was in need of nothing. He was strong, no question about that. And it was because he was strong that he changed this policy. Instead of strengthening himself against Israel, as we saw in verse 1, he now decided to save Israel by his strength. Do we see the difference? This is what it's meant when it says that he had riches and honor and abundance. Riches meant the wealth that came to him from these offerings and these gifts by the people and the nations. And it poured into Judah and accumulated to this enormous wealth. But when we speak of this in our terms, it means for us that he had been richly blessed with things in the truth. This peace, prosperity. In spiritual terms, he was blessed abundantly. And those blessings were given to him by Yahweh. These were all the results of this divine blessing. And so to us, what this means is that if we press on and work towards the things in the truth, if we soar high in God's Word and go about the task of educating each and every member of our body, of our ecclesias, and do our best to cause them to walk to the best of our abilities as manifestations of deity, then we shall be richly blessed. We will be blessed with successive generations of Christadelphians who would hold fast to the truth. This was the position that Jehoshaphat was in. And it's also brought about this enormous reputation, as we saw. He was known to be strong. He was known to have a great army, and his strength was sufficient, then, he thought, to save Israel from their apostasy. He thought that he could do something to change. He thought he could reach out to his brethren and help lift them back up from their weakness, from their weakened alliance, from their detestable false worship. And so he now decides that it's up to him to make this alliance, to go and help save Ahab from this battle. So again, possibly he thought he could restore unity in these two nations, just as the days of Solomon. Did he possibly think he could be as Solomon? This would be a good motive here for him to try to patch things up, to try to make it all well. But what about chapter 19, verse 2, where we read, Jehu, the son of Hanani, the seer, went out to meet him and said to King Jehoshaphat, "Shouldest thou help the ungodly and love them that hate the Lord?" What are you doing here, he's saying. "Therefore is wrath upon thee from before the Lord." So, we know that help and love are great motives. But good motives are never a replacement, brethren, for spiritual discernment. Good motives are never a replacement for spiritual discernment. Helping and loving must be based upon establishing divine principles and unity on those and those alone, with salvation in mind. Helping and loving must be based on divine principles with salvation alone in mind. Jehoshaphat joined affinity with Ahab. Joined affinity comes from this word in the Hebrew, chathan, meaning to give away in marriage. And it's ironic that that's exactly what he does. Giving away in marriage. The same as when Solomon made affinity with Pharaoh in taking his wife, or his daughter to wife, excuse me. So Jehoshaphat's foolish alliance that we will see take place here almost kills him. And worse than that, it lays the foundation for a series of events in Judah that almost destroys and extinguishes the royal line of Judah, the royal line of King David. And it all starts with this affinity and this wedding, a wedding with these two. In this case, it was his son that he gave away to contract by affinity, by marriage. And we understand that it was a practice of those times for kings to do this, for a political alliance, from one king to another, to intermarry. They would cement or confirm their alliance by marrying each other's families. And in this case, Jehoshaphat took for his son Jehoram Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. And think about this now. When we put the time periods together, we see that Jehoram, son of Jehoshaphat now, was only 15 years old. He was only 15. How many 15-year-olds do we have? Think about you as a 15-year-old young man being given away in marriage or marrying the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. Excuse me. Jehoram then, look at the meaning of his name for a moment. Jehoram means Yahweh hath raised. And this is what we saw, wasn't it, in chapter 17. Yah hath raised. He was raised. His heart was lifted up. But look at the meaning of Athaliah. That means Yah hath constrained. He hath constrained. And she was technically now, we talked about this, the ecclesia of Yahweh. We see that she was from the Samaritan ecclesia, we might say, in type, right? But she was not of the proper spiritual mindset. And this was the fate of Jehoram. We look over in 2 Chronicles chapter 21:6. Just for a moment to jump ahead. We see what the outcome was of this young man. 2 Chronicles 21, verse 6. And he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. Well, that right there tells you where he was going. Like as did the house of Ahab, even worse. Like he had the daughter of Ahab to wife, and he wrought that which was evil in the eyes of the Lord. So Yah hath definitely constrained, hasn't he, with Athaliah. And this is now the subject of chapter 18 as we move through. Chapter 17, the rising up, and chapter 18, Jehoshaphat and Judah being constrained or brought down. So even in these two names, we have a clear setting forth of what the two policies and the results of these policies will become. And it's unwise, then, in our lesson, it's unwise to look outside of God's boundaries for a mate, isn't it? It's unwise to look outside the spiritual bounds of the truth. Scriptural counsel for us makes it clear that this often leads to destruction. And we look at these verses, for example, because even when the intentions are good, too often it leads to an Athaliah and Jehoram situation where the truth is compromised. And what happens when that takes place? It's often completely lost. The truth is often completely lost when it's compromised to try to make an affinity or an alliance. And isn't it interesting that if we look at the periods of history with the truth, the Bible, most every single period of falling away is preceded by a casual attitude toward relationships outside of God's boundaries. So when talking about this relationship and this wedding, let's think about this for a moment. Kind of envision this one in your mind as we go through. In any wedding, there's a mountain of decisions to make, right? Planning to do, all sorts of things to consider, not to mention what it all means and what we're all working towards here and the joyfulness of the occasion, being joined together as one, right? Well, can you imagine? It's shocking, really, to think about how this event would have taken place knowing the differences between these two families. Ahab and Jezebel being haters of the things of Yahweh. The Hebrew people and the Sidonians were complete, utter opposites. And on every single detail that they had any reference or relation to the truth, these two families would have been miles apart, wouldn't they? Miles apart. But Jehoshaphat, he went through with it anyway. Jehoshaphat made his concessions. He swallowed his better judgment. And he was determined to align himself and his people with Ahab. All Israel was once again joined together in the spirit of unity and peace. He still believed he could save them at this point. Well, let's look again at chapter 18, verse 2. After certain years, he went down to Samaria, and Ahab killed sheep and oxen for him in abundance and for the people that he had with him, and he persuaded him to go up with him to Ramoth-Gilead. We see that after certain years, this was probably after about 10 years, he did this. Jehoshaphat went down. So it really didn't take long in the perspective of things. We look at the digression. He went down to Ahab to Samaria. Just like stepping down steps, isn't it? One at a time. Down to Ahab, down to Samaria. But we know from our map that Samaria is north of Jerusalem. So this is exactly what the record is trying to point to us. The record is presenting that he is going down in a spiritual decline. We might say that Jehoshaphat's change of character now becomes very obvious. And in other words, while he was a man with good intentions and a man of good motives, he compromised God's principles in pursuit of friendship and harmony and unity. He was rich in the things of the truth. Why, brothers and sisters, didn't he rely on that? Why didn't he try to bring them back to his position instead of compromising his own? Think about what we learn in the New Testament with regards to this. 2 Corinthians 6:14 and 15, "Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship, coming alongside, joining together, likeness of mind, what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? What communion hath light with darkness? And what concord hath Christ with Belial? Or what part hath he that believeth with an infidel? And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols?" They certainly had plenty of idols in the north. "For ye are the temple of the living God." Remember who you are. You are the temple of the living God. Do you want an idol present there with you? And this is what we are taught. There is no harmony. There is no unity. There is no sweet song when we compromise the things of the truth. Think about that for a moment. Harmony is when tones are mixed together. Tones are mixed together to form a beautiful sound, this harmony. A symphony of rich unison together. The notes all in tune in perfect unity and harmony. Ephesians 5, 19 and 20 says, "Speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord, giving thanks always for all things unto God." Think of that richness in that melody and that harmony. Well, as we continue in 2 Chronicles 18, we see that Ahab killed sheep and oxen for him in abundance. So not only did Jehoshaphat go down to Samaria, but he also took with him a whole host of people of Judah with him. And look again at the verse closely. Instead of Ahab making offerings to Yahweh, especially since he didn't worship Yahweh, the true God of Israel, he made offerings to Jehoshaphat. He killed sheep and oxen for him. This outward showing of his unity, this feeling he was trying to conjure up between them. All of this means to us is that he saw him coming, didn't he? He saw him coming, and he knew how he could convince him. He knew how he could completely sway him. He knew that he didn't have to keep him, but he had to get him on board to start with. And so they sacrificed for him. They began to build up this strong support and show that they were all coming together to welcome him in with open arms and offer these sacrifices of sheep and oxen. They poured it on thick, we might say, and so Jehoshaphat or Jehoshaphat, was convinced. And as the record says in verse 2, Ahab persuaded him to go up with him to Ramoth-Gilead. Now, what did Ahab know about persuasion? Well, we know exactly. He was married to the greatest persuasionist we might know of. In 1 Kings 21, we have the account of the killing of the innocent man Naboth and his sons by the evil and conniving plan of Jezebel, verses 9 through 10 of 1 Kings 21. We don't have time to go over there, but we're familiar with that. And we see that the account is summed up in a way in verse 25 of 1 Kings 21, where it explains how Ahab was moved to do such a horrific thing to an innocent man and his family. And it says there, "But there was none like unto Ahab, which did sell himself to work wickedness in the sight of the Lord, whom Jezebel his wife stirred up." Stirred up. Think about this man that we talked about, Jehoshaphat, risen, his heart lifted up, and now he was aligned with this man who had committed such horrific things. But look at this word stirred up. We see that this word stirred is from this Hebrew word sooth, meaning to prick or to stimulate. Kind of like when we were talking about yesterday, goading, to educate, to implore by education. Well, that's completely different now. We're talking about pricking, to stimulate, almost like in an annoying way. We can kind of think of this as harping and just relentlessly pursuing after something like this until you give in. So we think of this often or in relation to a verse in Deuteronomy 13, verses 6 through 10, from the root word for briars and thorns. Also in Judges 2 and 3, speaking of the Canaanites and the land and how they would prick as a thorn into Israel if they ever made an alliance with them. And of course, Jezebel was of the Canaanites of the land, and now she was pricking, wasn't she? She was poking through Ahab to convince Jehoshaphat. So here in the Kings, we see this man, Ahab, described as one who is being pricked as by a thorn and stirred up by his evil wife to do these things. And now he was passing it on to his fellow king in Judah. The word persuaded in 2 Chronicles 18 is the same word sooth, meaning to prick or to stimulate, as we see in 1 Kings. And so we see this is the policy by which Ahab is operating now in connection with Jehoshaphat. He had to keep prodding him and poking him and pricking him and convincing him to help go up. And this is what Jehoshaphat did. He proceeded to do this to Jehoshaphat, to give him, to even give him his firstborn in this alliance. And so in a way, this was really a death sentence, wasn't it? For Jehoram, his son, to marry with this daughter of Jezebel. Think about that. Think about that for a minute. A 15-year-old with Jezebel as your mother-in-law. A 15-year-old with Jezebel as your mother-in-law. Ahab had just showered him with the accolades of sacrifices. He blinded him and made him think that he was indeed strong and he had the capacity to help him. The importance that he needed there. But Ahab just wanted his army. That's all he was doing. He was using him because he wanted his 1,160,000 forces, men ready for the war. That's all he wanted. He wanted to preserve his own skin. And so he convinced Jehoshaphat to do this. He was now identified with Ahab, and it brought Jehoshaphat to a bitter and sorrowful low. And so we must be careful of the company that we keep. To finish this portion of our class, I want us to go through an anonymous quote that was written back in 1987, just for your consideration. And think if we see any similarities with Christadelphia in 1987, or 2015 for that matter, as we did with Ahab and Jehoshaphat. The quote begins, "The offer of union is dangled before ecclesias today like a carrot, before donkeys, not always on sound principles, however. We have sought to help the cause of unity where the issues are sound, but are opposed to mere union based on a policy of emotion, compromise of basic doctrines of the truth, or refusal to implement the terms of fellowship. It is useless pressing the value in the absence of what truly establishes it. Indeed, there comes a time when it is best to stand aside for the benefit of all concerned and wait patiently for the truth to prevail. There are many, the quote continues, there are many in different parts of the ecclesia world pressing for union without proper regard for the requirements of true unity, the elevation of Yahweh's doctrine and fellowship principles. In the absence of such, the warning example of Scripture is recorded for us in the failure of Jehoshaphat's policy of compromise, and this should be given careful consideration. He continues, to hasten the cause of mere affinity without the unifying influence of a mutual acceptance and application of the truth can set in train a course of action that can lead to a disastrous result. We cannot risk that on the eve of Christ's return. We need to strengthen the things that remain, and until a sound basis for true unity is mutually accepted, await the coming of our Lord, who will establish it on principles that will be honoring to Yahweh in doctrine and in practice. End quote. So when we go through this, we see that the quote speaks of sound principles in contrast to a policy of emotion. To faithfully implement the terms of fellowship, knowing the standards of our Master are high, and strengthening those things of doctrine that bind us together in the hope of our calling. Knowing that the time is drawing nigh, the writer says, we cannot compromise and then wait in regret of our fateful decision. We must do what is right. Be valiant for the truth. Teach it without compromise, and all lovers of the truth will approve. We truly must be careful of the company that we keep. So we'll stop there for today, and tomorrow we'll go more into the sacrifices and the offerings here on behalf of Jehoshaphat.